This is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University, and we're back. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker. Every week, we're talking about how to love ourselves, others, and a higher nature, how to improve our finances, career, health, relationships, and spirituality. And today, we have a very distinguished guest joining us, Evan Stewart, a senior partner at New York City Law Firm. He's also a professor at Cornell Fordham Law School. He's a contributing columnist for New York Law Journal, and he's published over 300 articles on legal subjects. He's also received the Stanford D. Levy Award, or Levy, for contribution to legal ethics. He's a popular guest on many legal financial issues on CNBC, CNN. And he's the author of his first book, The Man Nobody Knew. Welcome to the show, Evan.
Thank you, Alex. Pleasure to be here.
Yes, and this is really fascinating. So you wrote a very interesting book. This is the book here on this gentleman, Myron Taylor. And you call him The Man Nobody Knew. However, when I look at this book, this guy was a big industrialist, very successful business leader in the early part of the 20th century. He was also a person that helped with World War II in terms of being like a statesman and all that. But you call him Nobody Knew. Yeah, at the time, some people didn't know him. So why did you choose that title, The Man Nobody Knew?
So his first business career was as he essentially took over the textile industry. He was called the czar of the textile industry. And he made so much money from that, he decided to retire as a very young man and just sort of enjoy life.
How old was he when he retired, do you think?
Well, he retired several times. The first time he was in his early 40s.
Okay.
And then after a couple years of not really retirement, because he was on virtually every major corporate board, he saved Goodyear Tire. He basically merged two of the world's largest banks. But that's in, quote, retirement. Then his friend, J.P. Morgan, begged him, literally, to save U.S. Steel. And he reluctantly agreed to do that. And shortly after he takes over U.S. Steel, he's on every national magazine, the cover of every national magazine. And one of them, I believe it was Fortune, the subtitle was The Man Nobody Knows. Because here's this man who's a multimillionaire, very famous businessman. Now he's in charge of the world's largest company, and nobody knew him because he refused to give interviews. He refused to promote himself in the public, which is pretty unusual, to say the least. And that was his basic view of how he should conduct himself. He was very much a 19th century Victorian gentleman. He didn't wear his ego on his sleeve. And ultimately, that lack of need for self-aggrandizement makes him very, very important later when he switches careers to be a diplomat, Franklin Roosevelt, and then Harry Truman.
Interesting. But in terms of personality, you know, psychology, we see some people are either shy or they avoid people, and also, or they can be humble. What do you think was his personality in terms of why he avoided the spotlight?
As I say, he was very much a 19th century Victorian gentleman. He just didn't, he thought it was sort of bad manners.
Oh, okay.
To sort of flaunt his wealth, say how great he was. Because everything he did in his life, Alex, he was a tremendous, I mean, he was a phenomenal success.
Yes.
He had made an astonishing amount of money for that time.
Right.
He was, as we'll get into this later, his career in the World War II era, he really shaped the world, not only they lived in then, but the world we live in today. Is a very, very consequential man.
Yes.
But even during that period, when he was very, very famous, I mean, yes, when he was head of U.S. Steel, he was very famous. When he was a diplomat for Roosevelt, he was very famous. He still didn't seek out publicity. He didn't hold press conferences and say how great I am.
Right.
And that just wasn't the way he viewed the world.
Right, because I think you mentioned Victorian gentleman. I haven't heard too much about that, but I'm thinking of an English, maybe some proper kind of individual. But also in the Eastern approach, say in Asia, it's actually considered bad manners to, you know, promote yourself too much. They have a phrase, the nail that sticks out gets pounded down.
Yes.
So the Eastern approach is maybe somewhere along the lines of what he's talking about. I can also think like a humbleness, you know, the nature of the person that doesn't want to, you know, show off. But here's the point, though, Myron. Let's say, Evan. But I guess I see you guys connected. Let's say you're Myron today. Myron, we got Twitter over here. We got Facebook. We got to promote you. What are you going to say to that, Myron? Let's say you're Myron.
Well, as I say, when he was a diplomat in the World War II era, there were a lot of news stories about him, and he couldn't avoid answering some questions now and then.
Right.
So he would be part of our dialogue.
Okay. So you think he would be on social media today, but he wouldn't like it as much? Or what do you think he would?
No, he wouldn't be like Trump on social media. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
So let me take a step back to sort of put this in more context.
Yes.
So one of the reasons he was so successful in business and later as a diplomat is because you ask about how would he be today. His approach to dealing with people and handling problems, very different than the world we live in today. Hmm. He believed in sitting down with somebody who had different views from his and listening to them. And his point of view was, well, maybe the other fellow has a good reason for having a viewpoint that's completely different than mine.
Right.
That I think I'm right, but maybe he has some good reasons why he thinks it's right. Maybe I should listen to him.
Hmm.
And that was his approach in business. It was extremely successful. As I write in the book, he was the first leading industrialist to allow U.S. Steel to be unionized. And the country was shocked, absolutely shocked. And every other business leader called it, except J.P. Morgan, every other business leader called him a traitor.
Mm.
It was the smartest thing he ever did in business.
Yes. Employees make happy business is what he was thinking.
Well, and all the other steel companies were having terrible riots and not producing any steel.
Yes.
So U.S. Steel was making a lot of money. Its employees were happy. And U.S. Steel emerges from the Depression, the world's strongest and largest company. I think that's a win-win-win proposition.
Definitely.
And that approach, similarly, when he's a diplomat, is extraordinarily successful because he's not there shouting down people right. And saying, I'm right, you're wrong.
Right.
It's sitting there. Again, from this approach of humility, I don't think I'm always right. Even though he was a success in everything he did, his approach was, let me listen to the other fellow and try to come to an accommodation with him. And he was very successful in business and served him very well as a diplomat. And think about public life today. Do we have many, if any, people who are, especially the highest levels of the government,
right,
who approach our major problems that way? Wouldn't
right,
we
actually,
be better off?
Yes, that's interesting. So I want to get into the World War II because I'm fascinated. History was my second favorite subject back in the days, psychology, of course. But the issue of his personality style. So you're talking about what we call emotional intelligence. You know, Goldman talked about it. And empathy is a very important trait. Putting yourself in someone else's shoes and kind of thinking as they feel.
Yes.
Not always common in the business world, but people that can do that can be very effective in business and politics and things like that if they sincerely have that approach. It sounds like he did. So listening to people, empathy. Now, in terms of his business career, you talk about the Taylor formula, where he would come in and take struggling companies and modernize it, and also the union part, you know, helping them, you know, get their rights and all that kind of stuff. That really helped a lot. And the idea of the union, I think you mentioned that. So then from there, he had the big success with U.S. Steel, J.P. Morgan, all that, as you mentioned. And then he was appointed, apparently in 1939, as ambassador extraordinaire to the Pope Pius in Vatican, Italy,
correct,
during the time when Italy was pretty much going to join the Axis, or looked like they were looking, you know, to join the Nazi Germany in the World War II.
Yep.
So one question I have for you is, number one, why did FDR appoint him? Was this kind of a spy mission to get information from the Italians and also to influence the Pope? What was the thing behind it?
So that's a really good question. And it reveals so much about the type of person and politician and leader Franklin Roosevelt was.
Hmm.
So Roosevelt, incredibly, and I'll use this word in the best sense of the word, devious.
Cunning,
sly, person in public life. And there have been other very devious and cunning and clever presidents.
Right.
But Roosevelt really ranks right up at the top. And Roosevelt never did anything for one purpose. He always did things for multiple reasons. So one of the he had been thinking about and talking to the church, the Catholic Church, for a number of years about not necessarily reestablishing diplomatic ties with the Vatican, which had been broken off in the late 1860s, but attempting to do something in that direction. And he was trying to figure out how to do that without disturbing Protestant sediment in this country, because there was a lot.
I don't know much about the term Vatican. Is it like a city? Is it a government? What is that?
Okay, so, good question. So the Vatican is actually a nation state that was recognized by the Italian government in 1927. So the Vatican itself is a 12 square mile nation state sitting in the middle of the city of Rome. And the Pope is the head of the church, and he's the head of the Vatican. And it's one of the things I really didn't understand before I took on the archival research of this book. I can't speak about what the Catholic Church is today, but in the 1930s and the 1940s, it was truly an incredibly complex organization, not just in the Vatican, but in the United States. And not everyone was rowing the boat in the same direction, and it was incredibly complex.
Was it like a country, a sovereign country?
Yes.
So it's like Indian territory today is considered Indian land. Is it kind of like that?
Yes, it was it was a sovereign nation state sitting within Rome and sitting within the nation state of Italy. Yes. And that was recognized by the Italian government about 12 years before Taylor takes on this job.
Wow. But going back to my question, was this a spy mission in some way?
I wouldn't use that term. So, as I said, Roosevelt did this for many reasons. One of them, a very important one, was for domestic political reasons.
Yes, to gather information from the Italians?
No. The domestic reason was to shore up his political support among Catholic voters in this country as he's contemplating a third term. Another thing he's worried about is Catholic sentiment, which was very conservative, very isolationistic, and he wanted to somehow counterbalance that. Another reason to your question about the spy, not really a spy, but as the 1930s is coming to conclusion, right before World War II starts in Europe, before we get involved, virtually every embassy is being closed down. We close our Berlin embassy. Obviously, France is invaded. Poland's invaded. Pretty soon, there are no Western diplomats in any major Western European city or Eastern European city. The Vatican is one place in the world where virtually every nation has a representative. So that's think sort of like the United Nations today. Yeah. Everybody's there. So that's a source of great information to learn about. Well, people are talking to the German representative to the Pope. People are talking to the Japanese representative of the Pope. People are obviously Mussolini's there. It's a source of great information. Now, Taylor's not acting as a James Bond type spy, but being on the ground in the Vatican is a place where you can gain lots of information about what's going on. Another reason to go to the Vatican is to try to influence the Pope to be more favorable to our view of world events. Again, at this point, we're not in the war. Right. There is a war that's going on. FDR anticipates that we're going to be in a war. Right. It's not a question of if, it's when. And having the moral support of the Pope, not have the Pope be thinking he should be in a position of mediating a peace between the Germans and the West, because that was not a solution that Roosevelt thought was a good solution. He thought the fascists, especially the Nazis, were the greatest threat to world peace. He viewed the communists as a much distant second.
I see. Multiple. Well, when I was reading the book, at first I wasn't sure because you kept talking about how Myron would influence the Pope in relation to the war. But I'm thinking, this is a religious leader. Why would they listen to him? Why would Germany or anyone else listen to him politically? But I know you talk about the Vatican State. I see the power behind that. But what kind of power would the Pope have over, let's say, Hitler? Because I'm thinking Hitler, from what I've seen, he was raised a Catholic, but then he went away from that. He talked about being a German Christian and then an atheist. He valued science over religion. So why would he even listen to the Pope, say Hitler?
Well, because there are a lot of Catholics in Germany, number one. The Catholic Church in Germany was a political force, like the Catholic Church in the United States was a political force.
Well, aren't they more Lutheran in Germany at the time?
No, there are a lot of Catholics in, okay. And the Pope, in a prior iteration of his career, had been the nuncio in Germany. So he was very familiar with the German people. He was very familiar with the German form of, I won't say government, because government changed when Hitler ultimately took over. But so, look, Hitler was going to do what he was going to do. We know that, unfortunately, with the way history played out. But Hitler was not unmindful that the Pope had great moral/political authority with Catholic people, not just in Germany,
right,
but in Poland. Poland was an extremely Catholic country, right. And a lot of other countries in Europe, France,
right,
Eastern Europe, etc.
Right.
So he couldn't just bulldoze the Pope.
Oh.
He wanted to try to seek some accommodation,
right,
where the Pope would not be critical of him in public, and sort of, I won't say play ball with him, but the more he could. So, for give you an example. So, Hitler wanted the Pope to publicly praise Hitler's invasion of Russia.
Hmm.
And the Pope refused. And the Hitler was very angry about this,
right,
very angry about this, because he thought, well, I'm invading godless communism,
right,
which is the avowed enemy of the church. And so he was very angry about that.
Hmm.
So a lot of times the Pope did not accommodate Hitler.
Hmm.
The flip side to that, though, is the Pope is concerned with a lot of things. He's concerned primarily with the survival of the church.
Right.
So if you put the yourself, this is a very complicated subject, which is has been reduced to a lot of simplistic one-liners by a lot of people who are purporting to write history in this area.
Right.
Which I don't think is accurate. The Pope is worried about the survival of the church in Rome, in Germany, in Poland, and other places. And the more he speaks out or takes aggressive action about Hitler's atrocities and other things he does not approve of, the more he's putting at risk not just the church as an institution in Germany, but all the priests in Germany. It's not well known that 2,000 priests died at Dachau. It's not well known that a very large population in Auschwitz were Polish priests. Yeah, so Hitler took a lot of... Hitler was not just killing Jews and putting Jews in a concentration camp.
Right.
He was putting a lot of Catholics and Catholic priests in concentration.
So I would assume as the war went on, you know, being an authoritarian dictator, he would do more things on his own, I would think, Hitler would, and have less, you know, credence to the Pope. I mean, he became more desperate, from what I understand.
Look, right until the very last day of the war, Hitler and his henchmen were killing Jews, right? Even when they were losing the war, they still had this mindset, we have to kill every Jew we can.
Right.
So that was that.
Yes.
That being said, when you look at what's going on in Europe with respect to what the Nazis are doing with respect to not just Jews, but other people, like institutions like the church, Catholic priests. It really depends on what country you're talking about, Alex. You can't make a broad generalization that everything in Europe is X. It really depends what country you're talking about. So Slovakia,
right.
Terrible, terrible country, which was actually run by a Catholic priest.
Wow.
He is literally to the right of Hitler, if you can believe that.
I see.
And their internal memos in the Vatican, which I quote in the book, it's in footnotes, where people are complaining about this guy, saying people will believe that we can't control Hitler, but they won't believe that we can't control our own cardinal in Slovakia.
Are you a lawyer or a historian? It seems like you know so much about this stuff. Are you?
I'm both.
Okay. Are you both?
And to do justice to the subject, I've had to do a lot of work. I've done so. For example, and the reason is, Alex, that the Pope's role on this issue with respect to the Holocaust, what he knew, what he didn't know,
yes, I want to get into that.
What he did, what he didn't do,
right.
is one of the hottest issues yes. and controversial issues yes. Imaginable.
I can see that.
And
now, before we get into, I want to get into that part. That's very fascinating. But you know, my forefathers are from Spain. Now, you mentioned that Myron talked to Franco, apparently for an hour and a half, and convinced them not to join the Axis.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, first of all, Franco was a fascist. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so he considered a fascist. Now, he didn't join, but he was favorable to them. Apparently said they helped him out in some kind of a civil war or something.
You Germany, bet.
Italy.
Yes.
That's why he kind of liked them in a way. So why didn't he join them, since he's already fascist and everything?
Well, yes, you're right. Just put it in context, in the so-called civil war in Spain, it was sort of a precursor to the battles in World War II, where
yes.
Germans helped the Franco side and the communists helped the other side, and Franco prevailed. So he was predisposed to be thinking favorably.
He was beholden to them.
And he also thought Hitler was doing a good job in attacking godless communism. Right. He thought that was a good thing.
But an hour and a half conversation with Myron changed all that?
So on the way back from being in the Vatican in 1942, on the way back to Washington, of course, you didn't have jets that could fly nonstop across the Atlantic. So Taylor literally stops over briefly in Spain. On his way back to America, and the Franco contacts the U.S. Embassy and says, I really would like to meet this famous man, Mr. Taylor. So Taylor delays his trip back to meet with Franco.
So he was famous. You told me nobody knew him.
By this point, he is world famous.
Oh, okay.
By this point, he's now on his third trip to the Vatican.
Okay.
These trips, which are called the Taylor missions, are world famous, not just in America. The trip that Taylor takes in September of 1942, the German government is absolutely furious about this. They have no idea why Taylor's in Rome, what he's doing. The speculation about this is rampant throughout the world.
Did they ever try to kill him or capture him at all?
On the way back, before he gets to Spain, they actually tried to down his plane on an island off of Italy where there are German troops. Anyway, the pilot did refuse to land the plane. Anyway, so Franco asks to meet with Mr. Taylor. Taylor agrees. And there's a meeting with Franco, Taylor, the American ambassador, and an interpreter. And it starts off with Franco listing why Hitler's so great, and him invading Russia is so great, and all this is great, and it's et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Taylor listens to this a while, and he says, well, I want you to know something. It's not a question of if we're going to win the war. It's just a question of when. We are going to make so many planes, make so many tanks, make so many aircraft carriers, make so many this, that, and the other things. We are just going to dwarf the war material production of Hitler, and we are just going to crush him. Now, I'm giving the shorthand version of this message, but as the former CEO of the world's largest commercial enterprise, right? He has tremendous credibility on this. When he finishes his discussion and leaves, the U.S. ambassador sends a missive back to Roosevelt, says he's never seen anything like this. Franco, who started off ranting and raving, is literally left speechless. And he later writes in his memoirs, I never heard thereafter Franco ever talk about joining the Axis powers.
Oh, amazing.
Now, this has immediate important geopolitical consequences, because this is September of 1942. In November of 1942, we the Americans, for the very first thing we've done in the European war, is we land three sets of troops on the coast of North Africa, one in Casablanca. Had Franco closed off Gibraltar, that would have not happened. So the geopolitical implications of this chance meeting between Mr. Taylor and Franco have really profound consequences for the way World War II in Europe plays out.
Interesting. Now, the other thing is, I'm thinking about, you mentioned other countries that he tried to influence not to enter the war. Portugal, I think you said.
Mm-hmm.
And then Italy, but Italy did enter the war in 40, so he didn't succeed there.
Correct.
Is there a reason why?
Yeah, I mean, that's another reason why Roosevelt picked him, because Taylor actually had a prior relationship with Mussolini. He used to, in the mid-1930s, he used to go, believe it or not, grouse hunting with Mussolini.
Grouse? Taylor, is that like an animal or something?
Yes. Taylor had this fabulous villa in Florence that he and Mrs. Taylor would go to once or twice a year. And that was a time, believe it or not, in the 1933, 1934, 1935 period, when most of the world thought Mussolini was a very good leader. Right. That he had unified Italy, which, again, only had never been a true nation state until a couple of decades before, and that he was doing a good job. Winston Churchill used to regularly praise Mussolini in that time period. But anyway, Taylor had developed a friendship with Mussolini, and that was another reason that Roosevelt thought that he could personally influence Mussolini to die.
It didn't work. I mean, apparently... The desire for power got Mussolini's head or something?
By that point, Mussolini was basically hypnotized by Hitler.
Ah.
The power dynamic had started by Hitler looking up to Mussolini. By this point, it had flipped, and Mussolini was very much the junior power.
Okay.
And Mussolini really had delusions of grandeur, mm-hmm. recognizing he could not do as much as Hitler could do.
Right.
But sort of riding on his coattails, he might be able to develop a sort of mini empire in the Mediterranean.
I sure
so. And so by the time Taylor's over there trying to convince him and trying to use his good offices to convince the Pope to convince him, it's too late.
Right. You said that in convincing Franco, Myron talked about his position, you know, U.S. Steel, and we were going to make all these equipments and material. I think where's the word? And that brings us to the controversial Lend-Lease Agreement, which is giving billions to other countries to defend our country, which I think maybe Ukraine could be an example in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But this is going back to 40 to 45. And some people are isolationist in the U.S. You know, I don't want to give money to other countries. But for Russia, apparently, this is important because they were losing in the beginning, right? 41 or so to Germany.
They're getting crushed.
Yes. And then you said Myron convinced... who to do this?
So this is, there's so many new things that this book is bringing out that no one's ever heard about before. So the Lend-Lease legislation was initially designed to help Great Britain, but then Hitler invades Russia, and
so you're giving them food, equipment, everything, all that.
Oh,
stuff?
No, yeah, no, it's not really food. It's
military equipment,
tanks and guns, and,
okay. And transportation, I think, was important.
Oh yeah, yeah. So Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, tells the president, at best, the Soviet Union will be conquered in 3 months.
Mm. Wow.
I mean, they initially just, as George Patton would say, went through Russia like butter. I mean, they just went hundreds and hundreds of miles without much, and the Russian troops were in disarray, and Stalin had a nervous breakdown.
Mr. Lessing, we thought it was the cold winter that destroyed Hitler. Wasn't it the cold winter?
That contributed to it. But so anyway, so this happens, and there's a problem. Roosevelt knows that, again, not if we're going to get into the war, when we're going to get in the war. If Russia is taken out, again, this is long before Pearl Harbor happens. If Russia is taken out, then it's going to be Great Britain standing alone with no Eastern Front. Hitler can bring all his troops to bear on England. If England goes, then we're completely isolated. So Roosevelt has to somehow figure out how to get lend-lease aid to the Soviet Union. The problem is that there are two problems. One is the Catholic Church had issued an encyclical. It was actually drafted by the Pope before he was the Pope in 1937, that says any Catholic that does anything, literally anything, to help the Soviet Union will burn in hell for all eternity.
Wow.
And this was a well-known encyclical. The second problem is the largest group of isolationist sentiment to not get involved in the war in Europe in any way, shape, or form were Catholic in this country, Irish Catholics and German Catholics. So here
Because they don't like war, because it goes against biblical peace principles?
Well, the Irish Catholics hated the Brits.
Oh.
Right. And the German Catholics didn't want anyone to hate, to hurt mom and dad or grandpa or grandma in Germany, sort of thing. And based on the encyclical, the conservative priests in the United States were making open statements in church, which I quote in the book, that Catholic boys, 18, 19-year-old boys, would be justified in resisting a draft to fight in any European war to help the Soviet Union. I mean, that's pretty strong stuff, right?
Right, because they were atheists. They didn't believe in God or religion, apparently, at the time.
And they were persecuting the church in Russia. So Roosevelt's looking at this saying, okay, how do I get the church to play ball? And not, if they raise a fuss about this, Congress is going to get the, because Catholics have a very powerful constituency in Congress. If they raise a fuss about this, I can never raise any money to send to Russia or aid to Russia. So he sends Taylor on this mission to the Vatican in 1941 to get them to play ball. And we don't have enough time to go. I've already gone on long enough. It's a very, very complicated, right, very clever, devious in the best sense,
right,
plan. And ultimately is the church agrees, the Vatican agrees, the Pope agrees to play ball. And but the Pope essentially says to Taylor, after they spend a number of days talking about this, I understand how important this is geopolitically, but I cannot have my fingerprints on anything that suggests I as the head of the church, right, am disavowing this encyclical. So the plan is to decouple aid to the Soviet Union from aid to the Russian people.
Mm.
And the message is, I will send this back and we will have one of the most conservative isolationist cardinals in the United States issue a public declaration that will be covered nationwide that says the church does not oppose aid to the people of Russia, that the Pope loves the people of Russia. The people of Russia are in a terrible situation now, and they need the help, and they deserve the help of the United States.
What would happen if the Pope would have said, no, we don't want this to happen? Could that have interfered with the political side in the U.S. to send the stuff?
It would have been devastating. It would have been, because again, the established church was there were some, again, the church was not monolithic, especially in this country. Right. There were some members of the church in this country who wanted to help the Russians. Right. But in the middle western part of this country, Ohio, right. Chicago, Indiana, they didn't want to have anything to do with this.
So that's legislation may not have passed, you're saying, possibly.
It would have stalled in Congress.
Stalled, okay.
The fellow they picked was a cardinal in Cincinnati, the center of all this.
I didn't know the Catholic Church has so much power then and maybe now, or is it less now?
Again, I can't speak to now, but there was a fellow who at this point had died, but a fellow named Cardinal Mundelein, who was the cardinal in charge of Chicago,
right.
He was not just the most powerful spiritual leader in the Catholic Church in this country at that time. He was the most powerful political leader. He influenced a lot of votes and a lot of political behavior. So was the Catholic Church very powerful politically? Absolutely.
Okay, so that makes an important difference. So those billions of dollars worth of aid to Russia really helped them, I guess, survive, right? Maybe and win the battles.
No doubt about it. Stalin at the Tehran conference,
right,
literally said, had that lend-lease aid not gotten to Russia,
right,
we would have lost.
Fascinating. So basically, he did good things. He kept Spain out. He kept Russia in on the ally side. The world could have been different, right? Had these people changed.
Well, I'd like to say we'd all, not happily, but we'd all be speaking German. Had Myron Taylor not been successful
in getting the church
to play ball.
Right. But you said, the church has great power, but also comes great responsibility. And the thing about the Pope and the Holocaust and the Jewish, saving the Jews, you're kind of like, you're saying there's a lot of factors to it. Did he save the Jews, the Pope?
So the record there, there are two extremes. A lot of people call him Hitler's Pope.
Oh.
A lot of people in the Catholic Church say he should be canonized as a saint.
Hmm.
The truth, Alex, is somewhere in the messy middle of history.
Right. Myron brought the evidence of Holocaust to the Pope, you said, right? He showed it to him.
He's the very first person to bring written, documented evidence of the Holocaust in September of 1942 to the Vatican.
Did the Pope say anything about it at the time or no?
They weren't sure what to make of this evidence. They'd heard reports to this effect. They didn't know what to do with it. And more importantly, they didn't know how accurate it was. And they needed to think more about A, how accurate it was, and B, what it is they could do about it. Because as Stalin once supposedly said, this may be an apocryphal story, how many divisions does the Pope have? The answer is he has some Swiss guards, but that's it.
Right. But so, he has a lot of psychological power, right, you're saying, because there are a lot of Catholics.
So part of the problem with that this issue is people want to look at this issue with the hindsight of, hey, we won the war,
right,
the Nazis lost.
Mm.
Right. But give you an example. In 1942, when Taylor gives the first written evidence of the Holocaust to the Pope and the Pope's advisors, the Vatican is this 12-mile nation state surrounded in thousands of miles in every direction by totalitarian governments. Oh. And, Alex, they're winning the war.
Right.
As I said before, September of 1942, we've done nothing in Europe, literally nothing.
Right.
England's hanging on by a fingernail. It looks like Russia's going under. Remember, I said Secretary of War said 3 months. And he's trying to figure out, how does the world survive? How does the church survive?
Right. But by 44, 45,
it's very
Pope ever help with underground railroads or all that other stuff they did? Or?
Yes, he and the church saved a lot of Jews in Italy. Okay. The church saved a lot of Jews in Vichy, France. Importantly, and even some people who criticize the Pope have to acknowledge that he saved a lot of Jews in Hungary.
Okay. And then Myron was involved in helping the Pope understand that.
Oh, yes.
And
a lot of, so to go back, even back to 1942, a lot of people said the Pope never said anything about this subject. And that's simply not true. And Taylor's involved in this. In September of 42, he's urging the Pope and his advisors, you need to do more to say publicly what's going on here is simply morally wrong. It's against the laws of humanity. Yeah. It's just barbarous. And one of the Pope's leading advisors said to Taylor at one of these meetings in September of 42, well, the Pope's already said that. And Taylor said, well, he should say it again and again.
Right. And he was like a moral compass in some ways, Myron.
He was.
Was he a religious man, or did he have any spiritual
background? Yes. That's one of the clever things that was going on with Taylor's appointment by Roosevelt. Again, how cunning he is. Because of the strong anti-Catholic sentiment in this country,
right?
Taylor could not be a Catholic. He could not be a Catholic and have this job, because people would go absolutely ballistic. Taylor's a high church Episcopalian who's a vestry member of a church here in Manhattan called St. Bartholomew's.
Oh, okay.
So you appoint an Episcopalian to be a representative to the Vatican, which helps to neutralize the public criticism and the political heat that's coming after Roosevelt.
But why was there, I thought you said the Catholics were very popular in the U.S. There are a lot of them. Why would the people be?
They're very powerful, but very controversial. If you remember, not that you were alive then, but in 1928, Al Smith was the first Catholic to run on a national public ticket as for president, and he got absolutely slaughtered. And it was the vicious anti-Catholicism in that campaign was so ugly.
Oh, okay.
And fast forward to 1960, when Jack Kennedy ran for president, the anti-Catholicism vote was not as vicious.
But why did they hate Catholic? I mean, Catholics have a lot of Christian similarities. What was the negative side to it at the time? Yeah.
Well, today, in 2023, it looks like it's pretty silly, right? The Catholic Church and the Anglican Church in England—they used to be the same church. The only reason they got divided was the king.
Just like a bias, like, you know, if you're Italian or something.
Just because the King of England wanted to get remarried, you couldn't do that if you were a good Catholic. So he changed the Church of England, became the Church of England.
Interesting.
Not answering to Rome.
Yeah, a lot of interesting things.
The antecedents of these two religions, they all come from the same source.
Yes.
But in all those intervening time, those centuries,
right,
the suspicions, the doctrinal disputes became very profoundly important.
Yes.
Not to an outside observer. If you were Jewish, you'd say, well, those two religions are the same. But if you were a Protestant in the United States, you viewed the Catholic Church, it seems so silly today, but as like a totally different religion, very secretive.
Yes.
They do things. And more importantly, when Al Smith ran for the president, they said he can't be a good president because he's going to take orders from the Pope. And people actually believe that.
Evan, that's interesting. You're talking about the surrender of the Italians, I think it was in September 43, and then Mussolini, he was out in July. He said Myron had something to do with this.
Yeah. So Taylor, by at this point, is back in the United States doing a lot of other different things, post-war planning. He's the godfather of the Bretton Woods Agreement, which is the economic world we live in today. He's one of the godfathers of the United Nations, right? So, but one of the things is he's through the apostolic delegate in Washington, who's the church's big cheese in Washington, he's having discussions through the apostolic delegate with the church in Rome. And as the American troops are in Italy, General Patton has, of course, invaded Sicily, and it's clearly contemplated they're coming to hit the mainland. In the summer of 43, Taylor says to the apostolic delegate, you should get the message to the people in Rome that if they want to get out of this war in one piece, they've got to get rid of Mussolini. And the church's position always before this has been, well, we're not really the right people to do that. That's really the king of Italy. We're just the church.
Right.
And finally says, no, you don't understand. All this stuff about preserving Rome, preserving the Vatican, that's going to be at risk so long as Mussolini's still in power and calling the shots.
Who's influencing the church to influence the politics?
Yes.
The result.
Yes. So ultimately, the church says, okay, I'm sort of shortening the story here. Ultimately, the church goes to the King Emmanuel, and the Pope has a discussion with him that you really need to take charge of this, because we've heard from the president's representative on good authority that this is a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. Right. We're beyond sort of being nice now. If the United States invades Italy and really has to take the war fully into Italy, Italy's not going to be happy with this. You still have a chance to get out of the war. We're not using the term unconditional surrender, which is what we've said before about Germany. What we're saying is you can save Italy if you get rid of this guy, Mussolini. The church, the Pope, delivers this message to King Emmanuel. The report back, Taylor says to Roosevelt, the church has now intervened with King Emmanuel, and Roosevelt's reaction is, this is the first big break of the war.
Interesting.
And that's what King Emmanuel does. He says to Mussolini, you're going to have to step down. And later that day, Mussolini is arrested. And a couple months later, Italy's out of the war.
Yes. Now, the other couple of things is the influence on the church that Myron had. One is, apparently he said he helped block Germany from the Vatican mediating, which I wonder, wouldn't that be a good thing for them to mediate the war and stop it?
Well, certainly Germany thought that, because by that point in the war,
Were they losing the war big time.
Russia was just crushing them. I mean, the Eastern Front was in total. Well,
they wanted the Vatican to protect them, kind of in a way.
The Vatican ultimately saw through this. What they really wanted to do was to reach an accommodation with us, uh-huh, the United States, so that they could redeploy troops to shore up the Eastern Front.
Okay. So second trick, I think he did that earlier in the war too, right? He negotiated with all these other people.
Yeah.
And Prime Minister, what was his name in England that was appeasement or something?
Chamberlain.
Chamberlain, yeah. He would say, hey, let's do this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing is the unconditional surrender idea that seems like basically you just surrender and that's it. You said the Vatican was opposed to that for a reason?
It's sort of tied into your other question. So initially, this is another sort of interesting thing by Roosevelt. Roosevelt, early in the war, and this is one of the main reasons he sends Taylor over in 42 to talk to the Pope, has heard rumors about, and these aren't just rumors. I mean, these are quite substantial rumors. The Germans have made pleas to the Vatican to intercede to mediate an end to the war. And Roosevelt sends Taylor on this 42 mission, principally, it later has all these other elements like the evidence of the Holocaust. But the principal reason he sends him is to say, look, you got to understand that we, America, we're going to see this war through, because there can't be a true peace in the world with a negotiated peace with the Nazis. The Nazis are going to have to be defeated and just put out of commission. That's the only way there can be peace in the world. And so Taylor delivers this message to the Pope, and the Pope comes back the following day. This is a very complicated subject, so I'm trying to narrow it down here. But the Pope, after this very lengthy discussion he has with Taylor, it's one of the longest meetings Pope's ever had with anyone in history. Pope comes back the next day and says, I've thought a lot about what you said, and I want you to know we've never thought about peace on any terms or compromise just for the sake of compromise. We understand the moral values you're talking about, that the world must be restored with freedom of religion, freedom of thought, all the things that the Nazis don't believe in, right? And so this document, the one that Taylor's given, the two documents, the one he's given to the Pope and the one the Pope gives him back in return, Taylor brings back, first he has a meeting with Churchill in London. Churchill calls these documents historic documents, right? That we're not going to have a mediated peace. Everybody on the right side of the ledger thinks Nazism has to be destroyed.
Right. So the Pope eventually agreed, apparently, you're saying.
But it was interpreted by Churchill and Roosevelt that he agreed. This then, these two documents prompt Churchill at the Cairo conference to declare the unconditional surrender policy.
Right.
This then, for the remainder of the war, becomes very controversial, because not only do a lot of American generals think this is a stupid policy, it's only going to encourage the Germans to fight to the bitter end.
Right.
But the church thinks it's a stupid policy, because it's going to mean that if we totally defeat Germany and leave it without anything, literally,
just can I come back with more anger or something?
No. What they're worried about is all of Europe, all of Eastern Europe will be then just lay waste and be dominated by the communists.
Which, of course, happened in a way, didn't it? Of course, is exactly what
happened. So they are constantly during the war telling Taylor and others, this alliance you have with the Russians, you're being very unrealistic about it. These people are going to emerge as the most powerful people in Eastern Europe, and they're going to dominate Eastern Europe. They're not going to be friendly allies after the war's over. You're sort of riding the tiger. You know, remember the riding the tiger? What happens to the guy who rides the tiger? You end up inside the tiger. There are all sorts of memos that they write to Taylor and discussions they have on this subject. And so constantly throughout the rest of the war, the subject of unconditional surrender, he's constantly going back to the church, because the church keeps saying, you can't just leave the Germans just with nothing. You've got to.
So the church had a good point, apparently, right?
Yes.
Prophetic.
Yes, absolutely. But part of this unconditional surrender, which comes out of this 1942 meeting with the Pope,
right?
Which energizes Churchill, Roosevelt, to blurt out unconditional surrender. We're going to just drive these people down to dust. The church keeps saying, maybe that's not quite the best idea on how to resolve this.
Right.
And throughout the rest of the war, Taylor keeps having to be sent back to say to the church, stop meddling with this. Unconditional surrender means unconditional surrender. And the church keeps saying, do you understand what the consequences of that are going to be to Eastern Europe?
Yeah, it's amazing all these things interconnected and the long history. But I want to go back to the man a little bit. I know we're almost out of time here. The man, Myron, you talk about he been having a useful life. Now, we also use the term consequential for presidents, and we also talk about meaningful life. So tell me about that in terms of him. What made his life meaningful? Obviously, he did a lot of accomplishments, but in terms of his personality, what contributed to that, do you think? We talked about being humble and a gentleman and things like that. What's your take on that?
Well, I don't want to repeat myself. I do think this ability to see the other person's point of view, which again is really not part of our public dialogue today, unfortunately, it really made him a success. This, as I say in the book, his the fact that all he wanted to do was serve the president. He didn't have it. There's another man in government.
So ego was not like a big ego, per se.
Yes. There's another man in government, Harry Hopkins, very, very similar, that the president valued because he didn't want something from the president. He didn't want another job. He didn't want an appointment to this or something like that.
How about, was he a happy man? Was he happy? Did he have a family? Tell me about any of that.
It's interesting. As you looked at the cover in the book, his wife, Annabelle, they had a wonderful, loving relationship. That's a picture of them right outside of after a meeting with the Pope in the early 1940s.
He had children and everything?
No, they never had children.
No children. Oh.
That's one thing I don't know the answer to. I suspect that one or the other of them could not have children, but there's no document that I found that's his fault or her fault. Or
but would you say was he a happy man? Was he satisfied, you know, with his life? Would you say?
Yes. Yes. He was, he wasn't a happy go lucky back slapping sort of guy. He was sort of a stuffed shirt a little bit. He was this stiff collar Victorian gentleman and all that. But what's interesting is in the Roosevelt administration, particularly, not quite as much in the Truman administration, but in the Roosevelt administration, there were constant personality conflicts, people battling over bureaucratic turf, people who literally hated each other. Hmm. Guy who was the Secretary of State hated the Undersecretary of State, and the Undersecretary of State hated the Secretary of State. Hmm. Both of those men really liked Myron Taylor. The guy who was the Secretary of Defense, the first Secretary of Defense, Forrestal, people couldn't get along with him at all. He and Myron Taylor were very good friends.
Was he a shy guy internally? Because sometimes, you know, I read a book on personality types and love types and relationships, and some people are introvert, which energy is internal, and some people are shy, which is a fear of judgment.
I wouldn't say he was shy, but he was not a sort of a happy-go-lucky, back-slapping.
More introvert energy, like more internal, would you say?
I think it was the French ambassador to the Vatican. At various points, because Mr. Taylor's getting older, he suffered various ailments. And at one point, he's lying in his bed in the Vatican, propped up by pillows. And the French ambassador to the Vatican comes in to visit him. He says, even lying there sick in his bed propped up, he's sort of like a king, right? Oh. He exuded this authority, this sense of, because, right, he'd been the czar of the textile industry. He'd been the CEO of the country's most important industrial company.
Right.
He had that aura of gravitas. Mm. He was a serious man. Mm. He wasn't a happy-go-lucky, let's go have a couple beers kind of guy.
But people liked him, apparently, right? They
liked him a lot. They gravitated toward him. Someone who listens to your point of view,
yes,
and thinks it's important.
Empathetic. That's important.
People like that, especially if it's a very important person.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
When most people are dealing with important people, they think I've got 25 seconds or less
to impress them.
Yeah. Or they're going to turn away and talk to somebody else. Exactly. That's not the way Mr. Taylor approach the world.
You know how you ever see the movies like Raging Bull and others where the actor becomes that character, they inhabit it, you know, they gain weight or they, you know, mentally become that person. So I'm curious, Evan, are you Myron?
No.
And you have anything in him in you, do you think? Because you identify with this person, you wrote the book. Is there anything about him that you identify with?
I admire what he accomplished. I'm not projecting myself onto this book or the character.
Were you a humble guy? I mean, are you a loudmouth or anything? Or do you kind of?
Oh, I think no. I'm a normal guy. I have my good points and bad points, but I approach this, Alex, really more from the standpoint not just as a historian but as a lawyer. My job here was to uncover facts and to report them truthfully. So we were talking about the controversy about the Holocaust. A lot of controversy. I don't have unlike virtually anyone else who's written a book on the subject, I did not have a preconceived notion. I just went where the evidence took me. I did the work, and the evidence is in the book. You may not like it. You may object to it, but all my sources, you've read the book, you know how extensive the footnotes are.
Yes.
All the sources are there. But no, I'm not Myron Taylor. I admire the guy, but he's not perfect. Certainly I'm not perfect, but I think this is a faithful representation or reporting of a very consequential life.
Definitely. Myron, by the way, is very well written and it's entertaining. See, that's the important thing. You know, it's never boring. And that's maybe the highest compliment I can pay you, that it kind of weaves together. It's very fascinating. So it's been wonderful having you on the show, Myron, today. And Myron, Evan. And I guess I kind of, connect up. Well, you're both Cornell, right? Cornell graduates, yes. If I recall.
Okay. Yes.
And he established a Cornell law thing, right? Law school.
Yes. Yeah.
Where can we people hear more about you? Do you have a website or anything about the book and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So there are two ways to do this. One is if you Google my name and Myron Taylor, Evan Stewart and Myron Taylor, you'll see a lot of things pop up. You'll see the Amazon site. I think there are 18 reviews of the book on the Amazon site.
Is there a website specifically to?
There's my website at my law firm that you can access. Sure. You'll see that.
What is that?
It's just Google Evan Stewart, and you'll see my law firm.
Right.
You'll also see a speech that I gave at Cornell at the end of April. You can actually watch the talk I gave for about an hour. About the book. They taped it and it's up on the internet.
What is your legal specialty? What do you do?
I try cases. I'm a trial lawyer.
Okay. Related to civil litigation?
I've done everything. I've done mostly civil, but I've done one of my most famous cases is a criminal case, but mostly civil.
You're not in Miami these days, are you? Taking care of that?
Really?
You're not in Miami these days.
No.
You might get in trouble if you do that.
No. Lawyers still can pick their clients, and I'm staying away from that one.
Okay, great. Well, it's been wonderful having you on the show. I'd love to have you on again. Are you planning any more books or any projects coming up that will be interesting?
So I do have a second book that I'm planning based on, you mentioned before, I published 300 articles. I have about 25 articles about the worst Supreme Court cases ever.
Oh.
Which I'm planning to turn into a book. I think the public dialogue about the role of the court,
right?
People's concern about the legitimacy of the court.
Yes. Very controversial, I guess.
Extremely controversial. It's, again, a very dangerous time in our history. You have people targeting sitting Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. For violence, a possible assassination.
Wow.
It's a very troubling thing.
Okay.
But people should know that it wasn't just 2 years ago or a year and a half ago the Supreme Court did something that they might not agree with. Mm-hmm. In the 200 plus years of our country, Supreme Court's made a lot of bad decisions.
Would you talk about some of the good decisions too? Or is it all about bad?
No, just the bad ones. Because nobody ever talks about these. So. Oh, okay. People who go to law school, you're not taught about the bad decisions.
I see.
So even lawyers don't know. I was mentioning this last night at a dinner. Someone, a very, very distinguished member of the bar, I said, have you ever heard of this case? Never heard of it. Have you ever heard of this case? Never heard of it. Talking to a former Supreme Court clerk. Have you ever heard of this case? No, never heard of them.
Well, Evan, for sure, we'd like to have you back on board. Thank you for the time. It's actually been a nice interview. It went a little long, but it went fast. Which is good.
Well, you're very gracious, and I appreciate your questions, and I think we covered a lot of ground.
Fantastic. Have a wonderful day. This is Dr. Alex Avila, Love University. Class is now dismissed.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks, Evan. That was a fascinating interview with our colleague, attorney, and historian, Evan Stewart, who wrote about Myron Taylor, the man that nobody knew. And the elements of this are very interesting. The personality style of this individual who's very successful and contributed a lot was humbleness, empathy, humility. We don't see that as much these days in some of our leaders, but it is important to have that. That's a wonderful trait to develop, humbleness, and also a sense of empathy, kindness toward others, putting yourself in their shoes. We can develop those traits and also be great in our own way and have that love internally that we express to others externally as well. So until next time, this is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University. If you want to contact us, you can reach us at loveuniversity.love. Call us at 310-226-8090. Write to us at loveuniversitylove@gmail.com. You can download the podcast on SoundCloud, Spotify, Podbean, and iTunes. You can also follow us, like us on Facebook and Instagram at Love Letter U Podcast, and follow us on Twitter at Love Letter U Podcast. So until next time, this is Dr. Alex Avila. Put away your notebooks, your iPads, your phones. Love University class is now dismissed.